So welcome everyone to a Wednesday evening Clear Mountain live stream. And today I wanted to just talk a bit about a question which comes up quite a lot for practitioners, which is why you or we or I chose the path in Buddhism, which I did, which we did. And for a bit of context, most of you will know that in Buddhism, we divide the kind of extant schools into roughly three. There's Theravada, which means literally the way of the elders. And that's the school most prevalent in Southeast Asia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Burma, Laos, etc. Then you have the Mahayana, which is sort of in East Asia, including China, South Korea, Korea as a whole, and Japan. And then you have the Vajrayana, which is extant in Tibet. And that has many Mahayana teachings, but also mixed with certain tantric teachings, which came up from Northern India in the Common Era. And also has a good dose of Bon, which was the sort of religion of the original religion there before Buddhism came up. So, but it's very much adjacent to Mahayana and holds up the Bodhisattva ideal as its aspiration. So the Mahayana and Vajrayana schools basically aspire to a state of the Bodhisattva, which is a being that has decided to renounce their own awakening for the sake of pursuing or helping all beings attain awakening, and determined to remain in some sense in samsara, the endless round of rebirths, until all beings are freed. And there are certain bodhisattva vows, which are often given, including vows such as sentient beings are numberless, I vow to free them all. Dharma doors are endless, I vow to master them all, and so on. The Theravada, which is based more on the early Pali canon, most of the Vajrayana sutras came about 5 centuries after the Buddha passed away, beginning with the Prajna Paramita literature, and continuing on then with many different later sutras. The Theravada aspires to the Arahant ideal of one who attains Nibbana, unbinding, awakening from the round of rebirths. And there isn't a mention of remaining in samsara for the sake of all beings. So the question often comes up, isn't Theravada selfish? And why would you pick that path over the other? And this is, you know, we don't usually bring it up directly in dialogue or too directly, and we're delicate around it. But it's in the air, and you do in some Mahayana circles encounter this view that the Theravada is a bit selfish, and the Arahant ideal is liberation for one's own benefit, is looked down on. And I think it's a question we've all had to struggle with. I mean, how do we justify looking to our own awakening? So I think there's a few ways of approaching this question. And, you know, the first is to note that I'm going to be speaking very much from, there's going to be a bit of speculation here, things I've heard from various teachers, and to hold what I say lightly. But it's been an important process for me. So I'd say personally, when people ask me that question, I have just always resonated deeply with the Pali Suttas and the Buddha's original teachings, the clarity and cohesion and crystalline, how pristine the Pali canon is. I've just found so practical, and it's just felt intuitively right to me to practice those teachings. But in terms of looking at that wider scope, I think that there's a few useful kind of things to look at. One is that, you know, first, when Ajahn Amaro notes that whenever the bodhisattva vows are given, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to free them all. Dharma doors, Dharma gates are numberless, I vow to master them all. That they're always given in tandem with teachings on emptiness, such as you find in Nagarjuna, the Madhyamaka teachings, etc. And I think there's a case to be made for the idea that you might take these vows, and then there really might come a point where you vowed to free all sentient beings, and then you realize all beings are empty, and something happens, awakening. I think it's also worth noting that in certain biographies, say of one of the most famous of the Tibetan yogis, bodhisattvas, Milarepa, the biography, which was written in around, I think, 12th century AD, ends with it saying that Milarepa ascended to the Dharmakaya. And, you know, what's that exactly? So this idea that things may not be as simple as we at first believe they are. In Mahayana, often we're sort of told of three Dharma bodies. There is the Dhammakaya, which is sort of the, reference a few documents on the computer while we talk actually for this. There's the Dharmakaya, the body of truth, or the essential divine body, the unmanifested mode of the supreme state of absolute knowledge. The Sambhogakaya, the body of enjoyment, or the celestial divine body. So these are like the celestial bodhisattvas, Green Tara, Guanyin, etc. And then the Nirmanakaya, which is the body of transformation, the Buddha that manifests here and now in the physical world. And it's interesting to note that I think a real question comes up about what the Dharmakaya in Mahayana is exactly. Is it actually different than Nibbana as the Theravada conceives of it? And there is, you know, a lot of interesting ways to kind of think about that, because when you read Mahayana treatises talking about the Theravada and the Arahant ideal of a self-awakened being, often you get the sense they're not talking about what we're talking about or what the Pali Suttas are talking about when it talks about an Arahant. In the Pali Suttas, it's the awakened mind outside of space and time, the liberated citta. In, say, Nagarjuna or other prominent Mahayana philosophers, the Arahant is very much talked about as a being that is more or less in a state of deep concentration until their encounter a Buddha, in which case the Buddha instructs them further until they can attain the state of bodhisattva-hood, the state of a bodhisattva. In Nagarjuna's commentary on bodhicitta, you see this depiction of the Arahant. And you really get the sense that the Mahayana, maybe when they talk about the Arahant, is actually talking about what we talk about when we speak of, say, a being who has attained a deep state of jhana and been reborn into a formless realm or into a one of the Brahma realms, something like that. But that this idea that an Arahant, it's a temporary state of immersion in something, that's not what we talk about in the Theravada when we talk about Nibbana. So I think there really could be an issue with language here. You know, and the other thing to note is the Theravada and Mahayana conceptions of the Bodhisattva are different. In the Mahayana, there seems to be the idea of a state of the citta, where it has attained a freedom from samsara, but can still manifest for the out of compassion for all sentient beings within samsara, one foot out of space and time, and yet able to operate within that realm. Whereas in Theravada, when Zhuanzang, one of the most famous Chinese pilgrims, and I'm saying that name completely wrong, in 9th century AD or so, visited India, he doesn't say he encountered Theravada. He says he encountered Theravada Mahayana. And this kind of mixture of Theravada and Mahayana schools all together. And that's actually much more what you find in Thailand, is you do have many monastics practicing for liberation, Nibbana, in this very life. But you also have many who have made the aspiration to remain for lifetimes, building barmi, as they put it, like building spiritual qualities such that eventually when they do attain awakening, many of them are hoping to attain awakening as a disciple of a future Buddha, Maitreya, or as a Buddha in and of themselves. So these are two different ideas of how you are a bodhisattva. But that ideal is very much prominent in Thailand. And you hear it spoken of in the biography of Ajahn Mun, written by Ajahn Mahabua. It talks about how he realized, Ajahn Mun, during the early phases of his practice, that he'd made a vow in previous lives to be a bodhisattva, to attain Buddhahood, and that this vow was actually kind of binding him to samsara. And he relinquished that vow and was able to, by all accounts, attain Nibbana, awakening in this life. And so in the Theravada conception, I think there's this, it's more mysterious than just, us aiming for liberation and then we've stepped out of samsara and others can, continue on as they will. I'm reminded of a interaction where Longpo Sumedho was with Ajahn Chah, and he said, "Ajahn Chah, I've just decided I'm going to give it my all. I'm going to attain awakening in this life." And Ajahn Chah just kind of looked at him and said, "Well, what about the rest of us, Sumedho?" And, obviously it's funny because Longpo Chah was by all accounts an arhant already, but this pointing to how when you focus on yourself too much, the practice is broken. It doesn't progress. And, the Buddha said, if you want to benefit others and yourself, practice for awakening. It was the goal that he really held up as needing no other justification in terms of society, in terms of anything. And it's interesting because I feel like the paradigms we usually hold for justifying, say, awakening might really fall away when you consider that state which was beyond words. I've heard someone say that a bodhisattva determining not to attain liberation until all beings have attained liberation is a lot like a sleeping man, a dreaming man, determining not to wake up until all of the people in his dream have woken. And I don't know if that's true, but I think it's possible. And I think it's possible that Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah, obviously they'd spent many lifetimes, if you believe in such things, building huge spiritual qualities of wisdom, of compassion, of skill in teaching. And yet the fact that they chose to attain Nibbana, liberation, at the exact moment in history that they did, released a supernova of goodness at exactly, I think, the correct moment where maybe they couldn't have done any, it was the moment where they could have done the most possible good, the summer of faith and practice and purity, which Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah ushered us into, is a season we still are basking in. They may have done the exact right thing at that moment for the benefit of all sentient beings. And similarly, for many of us, it's one thing to kind of think that practice is this clear metric of if I don't attain stream entry or awakening this lifetime, I've failed or fallen short. But, you know, maybe the Dhamma has a quality of mystery and grace where, yes, we do our best to, you know, purify the heart now, but maybe many of us will remain in samsara for a few more lifetimes and do some good on the way. And I think it's important to note that for me, there's never been a fork in the road. You know, good practice is good practice is good practice. I've never seen this idea of like, if you are out there doing service and sacrificing your own meditation, you're serving others better. You know, I've seen, I think what it, you know, with some teachers who've got profound states of concentration, their metta, their bodhicitta, as it might be called, is supercharged. It's just, it's not like one's practice, if it's done well, if it's walked in line with the middle path, ever for me has conflicted with the benefit of all beings. It's one path. And I've never felt that split in the road. So I think that's worth kind of pointing to in our own experience. And I think another thing just to kind of highlight is that what the Mahayana talks about in terms of these three bodies, the Dharmakaya, the celestial bodhisattvas, and the incarnate body, it might really be not far, or maybe the deeper you delve into the Theravada, the more you realize that the Buddha taught just what was necessary. And there's a lot of room for mystery. And I think part of that mystery really might include elements of what the Mahayana talk about. I'm not sure that these goals are different, actually. So I want to read one passage from the biography of Ajahn Mun, which some of you will know, written by Longtham Mahabua. And basically, it's him talking about the night of his awakening, or sorry, the days after he attained Nibbana. And he was visited by a bunch, a large congregation of Buddhas and their disciples. And he asked, "How are you visiting me? I thought the awakened mind was non-manifest." And the Buddha explained to him in this vision, "If those who have attained anupadesesa nibbana, enlightenment without remainder, enlightenment, full enlightenment, wish to interact with other arhats who have purified their hearts but still possess a physical, mundane body, then they must temporarily assume a mundane form in order to make contact. However, if all concerned have already attained anupadesa nibbana without any remaining trace of relative conventional reality, then the use of conventional constructs is merely completely unnecessary. So it is necessary to appear in a conventional form when dealing with conventional reality. But when the conventional world has been completely transcended, no such problem exists. All Buddhas know events concerning the past and future through nimittas that symbolize for them the original conventional realities of the occurrences in question. For instances, when a Buddha wishes to know about the lives of the Buddhas who preceded him, he must take the nimitta, the sign, of each Buddha in the particular circumstance in which he lived, as a device leading directly to that knowledge. If something exists beyond the relative world of conventional reality, that being vimutti, liberation, then there can be no symbol representing it. Because of that, knowledge about past Buddhas depends on mundane conventions to serve as a common basis for understanding, as my present visit illustrates. It is necessary that I and all of my arhant disciples appear in our original mundane forms so that others like yourself have a means of determining what our appearance was like." So what's very interesting there is this acknowledgement that you don't see in the suttas, but with a teacher as respected as Ajahn Mun, that, you know, Nibbana is not nothing. And, you know, perhaps there's echoes of what the Mahayana seems to speak about when they talk about celestial bodhisattvas there. I've heard a teacher I deeply respect talk about how the awakened mind can leave kind of an imprint on the cloth of samsara that can kind of resonate over time. I've heard it referred to as the merit body. You hear about, there's a wonderful Q&A with Longpo Pliyan, where a monk at Nanachat asks about this instance with Ajahn Mun. Ajahn Pliyan was an unbelievably respected monk. And Ajahn Pliyan goes into this whole discourse about how, you know, many awakened teachers have had these visions. And it's really funny because he says this all in Thai. And at the end he says, but don't translate any of that. Just practice. And you can kind of hear this collective sigh from everyone in the audience. And even Ajahn Panyavada, one of the most well-respected Western monks, there's this one Q&A where someone asks him, if you pray to the Arahants, if you ask them for help, will they ever respond? And he says something, it's not a no. I think he says something along the lines of it might be possible. So what I'm pointing to there is not some point of doctrine. I think the Buddha was very judicious in what he talked about and what he didn't. And I think he left Nibbana largely undefined because it's beyond words. But what I point to there is that space of non-definition could include a great deal, and it's mysterious. And I don't have confidence that what the Mahayana is talking about with the bodhicitta, the liberated mind of the Buddha, is any different than the Arahant mind, and that there can't be this active, that, you know, and by our definition, the Buddha's liberated mind is Nibbana. So I just wanted to kind of flesh all that stuff out in terms of my own thinking around it. And to say that for me, with all this landscape kind of outlined, it's just really important to come back to what the Buddha's words were and to acknowledge that for me, the Theravada, the Pali Suttas are the rebar and the foundations of our practice. You know, these are what the Buddha definitely said. And the Mahayana Sutras have profound wisdom in them. I mean, Tibet's been turning out awakened beings for millennia. And yet, I think it's important to have one foot in those Pali scriptures to really be able to measure what the Mahayana Sutras, which came later, they came 500, 600 years later. There's no question in scholarship anymore around this. Just these questions about if a Mahayana Sutra is providing extra skillful means, if it's fleshing out some part of the heart of the practice, which we really need and feel hungry for, then it can be really useful to use. But if there's ever this point where it diverges from what the Buddha said, then I think it's really important to note that. For example, there's a point in the Lotus Sutra where it says that the Buddha didn't teach the Bodhisattva path initially because he was worried people at the time couldn't take it. And so he initially ushered them into Arahantship in hopes that eventually then, when the time was right, he would help usher them into the Bodhisattva ideal. And the analogy is given of a burning house and a father trying to get his children out, and they're fascinated with these toys they have. And so he lies to them. He says there's toys outside to get them out of the house. And once they're out of the house, they're safe. And similarly, the Buddha kind of drew us into a state of, you know, held up Arahantship as a proximate goal, but really it wasn't what he was aiming at. And for example, in this sutra, the Buddha was clear that he would never lie. And the Buddha was clear that his teaching, he called an open-handed teaching, meaning that it was all there. There's nothing esoteric. There was no hidden teaching. And so, you know, when you come across a point of contradiction like that, I think it's important just to put a flag in. So in the end, I think a lot of us have Mahayana karma. I believe I do. And I don't know what my path is. I don't know if, you know, I'm going to try my best to purify my heart as well as I can this life and to help others. But maybe I'll have a few lifetimes and I'll do some good in the process. Who knows what my path will be. But just to know that there's a place, I think, for putting down this, I see it as quite a false dichotomy. and to step back into what is the practice now for us, and to acknowledge that where that path leads, where that sense of rightness, what feels like good practice, that endpoint really may not be as different as we think. And if we're practicing well, we're doing immense good, whether it's Theravada or Mahayana. So in some sense, I think this whole talk is to try to give kind of a quiet defense of the Theravada as a quiet vehicle of compassion, and to just dispel this dichotomy. Feel where the Dhamma is guiding you, feel what the middle path is, and trust that. And as soon as you get too far into these realms of measuring what that end goal might be, I think you can kind of take the wider realm of mystery that all this kind of points to as a good kind of way to step back and just to come back to what the Buddha said to do, how he said to practice well for the sake of oneself and of all beings. So I think we have time for questions if people have anything they'd like to discuss. Please just type it into the chat. Good to see everyone. Singapore, Burma, Joseph. The Buddha said samsara is without beginning or end. That implies that the bodhisattva ideal is impossible to achieve and is therefore, if adopted, a guarantee just to never escape samsara yourself. Yeah, once we asked Ajahn Anand about this with Avalokiteshvara, the bodhisattva who is determined to remain in samsara until all beings have attained awakening, and Ajahn Anand, there's a whole shrine at Mapjan where I ordained for Avalokiteshvara. And Ajahn Anand said, well, he can change his mind, but there's always someone in that station. Ajahn Anand talks about Arya Bodhisattvas, who are beings who have attained enough parami, that they could attain awakening at any moment. Once again, like maybe the Bodhisattva vows are actually just a skillful means to achieve an awakening, which can coexist outside of time with samsara, and maybe that's what those sutras are pointing to. Or maybe it's maybe it's something that steers the chitta towards compassion for a time, but then eventually one does relinquish those vows. The Buddha said he didn't give a clear answer when he was asked if samsara would ever end. In the Samyutta Nikaya, where the Buddha emphasizes that the cycle of samsara is so vast that it cannot be measured or completely comprehended fully. Instead, the focus is often placed on the nature of suffering, dukkha, and the path to liberation, nirvana, rather than on the origins of samsara itself. Yes, I think that's a great point. And the Buddha talked about the achintaya dhammas, which are the things that contemplating would cause one's head to explode and weren't useful, which is the domain of jhana, so what a being with jhana can do, the domain of the Buddhas, so what a Buddha can do, the exact workings of kama, and yes, I believe the beginnings of the universe. Although it's worth noting that in Buddhist cosmology, we are in a cycle of infinite universe evolutions and devolutions, big bangs and big crunches, which is unbelievably prescient cosmology for a system developed 2,500 years ago. Okay. Can we boil everything down to clinging as a map to determine how far we are from the Buddha and the Dhamma? Yeah, I think that's a good metric. Insofar as we cling, upadana, we're buying into avijja, ignorance, and steered by it. And That's as far as we are from vidya, or knowledge and wisdom, which are its opposites. And I'd say this question gets a little at the heart of this topic just by, you know, pointing to the fact that I think skillful action and practice never have to be guided by attachment. A treatise called The Ornament of Mahayana Sutras discussed the issue about the authenticity of Mahayana. One argument which I think is quite interesting is, if the Mahayana teachings are not the words, are not Buddha Vachana, which is, or I think what he meant to say is Buddha Vachana, which is the words of the Buddha, then how did the current learn to become one? And two, the Agamas emphasize so much about suffering and such, so if those were the only teachings of the Buddha, practitioners would just strive for quick liberation instead of bodhisattva paths. And three, if only other Buddhas taught the bodhisattva paths, but not the current one, then what that would mean, the current Buddha's merits are not equal to past Buddhas. I don't totally know. Actually, I don't know if there's completely a question there, but I will say that the idea in the Mahayana is that later sutras from the Paraprajnamita on were either given by later bodhisattvas or were given by the Buddha to the devas or the nagas, actually, and then held for 500 or 600 years and then brought back to the realm of human beings, basically. I find that lineage quite questionable. I think it's more likely that they came from mostly from very, very wise people later, and possibly awakened people, at least some of them. And it's worth noting that those changes seem to have started around the turn of the century, or turn of that common era, when writing became more prominent. Because in the initial phases of Buddhism, teachings were passed down by groups of monastics chanting together. The word Nikaya, so you know, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Digha Nikaya, these compilations of teachings, it referred to a group of monastics that would chant together the whole Digha Nikaya, the whole Majjhima Nikaya. And that would be the kind of purpose of that monastery, would be to preserve that Nikaya. And oral transmission is unbelievably accurate. Because if you miss a syllable, you have 20 other monastics right there to catch it. Writing is what is unreliable. And so as soon as writing comes into the picture, more prominently, and the teachings begin to be passed down through writing, that's when I think we see this proliferation of other teachings and the potential for redaction and editing of the original Buddhist teachings as well. Do you want to be a bodhisattva, Bhante? I want to practice well for the sake of myself and all sentient beings. I want to follow the Dhamma as sincerely as I can in this life and give everything to it. I want my whole life to be just an offering to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And there's never been a fork in that path between Arahant and, you know, my own benefit and others' benefit. Always, even when I went off to Thailand, I mean, I just felt like this is the best thing I can give the world, is to ordain. So I don't know what my path is. I think I definitely have some Mahayana karma in me. But the Dharma is mysterious, and I feel like it, you know, to personify it, I feel like I will be guided. You know, maybe I'll chain awakening this life. Maybe I'll stick around for a few lifetimes or many and benefit all beings, but I'll just follow the Dhamma as best I can now. And the Theravada and the Pali Sutras have just always been the ones that resonate. So that's my answer to that. Venerable Sir, if the Noble Eightfold Path is the best of all conditioned things, and the merit of making offerings to one merely on the path is, to stream entries, immeasurable. Oh, whoops. I think Joseph's question got displaced there. Okay. Wouldn't offering the merits of our cultivation of the Noble Eightfold Path to be the most meritorious offering to all beings? Could you speak about a bit about being about the Theravada dedication of threefold bliss? Yeah. Yes, Dhamma Puja is the supreme offering. I guess actually, I kind of just think I spoke a bit about that. My own life is an offering. Yeah, and I think it is immeasurable. And to say that when you do, you know, there are beings in Thailand who I believe are arahants now, and there's an emptiness, not a blank emptiness, but like something, a gift given to a being like that. There's something that echoes endlessly in it. It's, you know, it's not a simple metric of an arahant attains liberation and then they're leaving the rest of us behind. They embody something deep, immeasurable, profound, like the ocean, as the Buddha says in the Vajragota Sutta. Okay, I think we have time for one more. It is always interesting reflection to compare the two yanas. Isn't there also a sutta where the Buddha distinguishes two practicing monks where one is more praiseworthy? I think that's the whole question. Yes, there is. Well, there's many where he draws distinctions between monks. One, and I think the one you might be referencing, is he comes across a monk calmly meditating near the city, and then a monk nodding off in the forest. And he says, of these two monks, I praise the one meditating, nodding off in the forest more than the monk meditating calmly near the city, because the one near the city will soon be approached by attendants, by followers, and bothered, and his concentration will fall away. Whereas the one meditating in the forest will eventually attain liberation, you know, samadhi, because he'll actually have the space and seclusion. Yeah, and I think this points to the necessity of, it's not selfish to take time to get our practice together. Like, you don't look at a surgeon in med school, you know, and ask like, why are you being so selfish taking those 8 years learning to do surgery? Just get out there. There's people who need help. Like, they need training, and we are very sick. We need some time to heal our own hearts. And that can be done in tandem with others, but you know, that simple metric of being immersed in the world and entangled in it versus being one of compassion and benefit and altruism versus one that allows for seclusion and pulling back, being one that's selfish, is an utterly false metric, completely false. And once again, the only way to really figure out that balance for yourself is to practice and discern the Noble Eightfold Path for yourself. So I hope, I don't think we're going to fit all these questions, but we will continue on Zoom for those who want. And yeah, it was great talking to everyone. I like these Wednesdays because we can kind of delve into these particular subjects a bit more. I posted the link into the chat if you want to continue on Zoom. Otherwise, if you can't see it there, just log into clearmountainmonastery.org, scroll down to the Wednesday evening live stream event, and you'll find the Zoom link there. So take care, everyone, and have a good practice.